Thanks for spending some of your day with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Just wanted to give a quick shout out and thanks to all the folks in Bayfield, Wisconsin, for our Bayfield in Bloom event this past Friday. Lots of wonderful people, full house, and great job by everyone in pulling that off. Really enjoyed my time there. So thanks to everyone who visited us in Bayfield. Appreciate it very much. Today we're turning our attention to the law. Madison lawyer Michael Riley back with us today. And we're going to talk with him about Wisconsin's bail system. We'll talk about identity theft and car insurance. Mike's practice is focused on getting fair compensation for people who suffer injuries due to other people's negligence. And he also represents clients in insurance coverage issues, in mediation and arbitration. So as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Have questions about car insurance? Maybe you want to learn more about Wisconsin's bail system. Join the conversation. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Mike Riley, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Oh, it's great to hear your voice, Larry. A pleasure to be on the show.
Wisconsin's minimum car liability limits are $25,000 per person and $50,000 per occurrence. And I know most homeowners policy have liability coverage of, I think it's $100,000. How do you determine if you have enough adequate insurance coverage?
Like a lot of it, Larry, really does depend on what you have. I mean, obviously, if you're a young person with no assets, who doesn't have any savings, doesn't have a home, doesn't have any of those things, you know, you have a lot less to lose. And, you know, you may not need as much insurance. But I would tell you this, at $25,000, we talk about $25,500 a lot. And just so people understand, the $25,000 means the most one person who is injured, whether it's you who are injured or you injure someone else, is $25,000. If there's a number of people injured in an accident, your maximum coverage would be $50,000 if we're talking about a $25,500. A lot of policies are $100,000, $300,000, and of course, there's all sorts of variations. The problem with the $25,500 is pretty simple, and that is that medical costs have gotten so high that a trip to the emergency room, if somebody has, you know, some x-rays taken, perhaps an MRI or some other kind of study, just to see how serious their injuries are, you can have a bill of close to $25,000 from an emergency room. And it just doesn't take long in any kind of case for somebody to rack up bills of 10, 15, 20, and of course we see bills into the hundreds of thousands. I've got two cases now where the overall medical bills are $300,000. So, you know, obviously if you're in, most accidents aren't that serious, of course, but even a relatively minor injury that doesn't simply go away in a few days, if all you've got is $25,000, you don't have enough. And if you don't, then a couple things can happen. Your insurance company ultimately will pay those policy limits. One of the things to be concerned about if you don't have enough coverage is normally the insurance company is obligated to defend a lawsuit if someone sues you. But Wisconsin and a lot of states have what we call pay and walk, which means that the company, if they choose, can say, you know what, this case is clearly worth way more than your limits, so we're going to pay those limits, and now you're on your own. Again, maybe you don't care a lot if you don't think a judgment against you is going to be that serious, but those judgments sit there for 10 to 20 years. They're going to impact your credit. They really are going to have a very negative effect on your life. So not having enough insurance really is a very bad decision. And, of course, if you have more assets, you stand to lose them. I represented a client not too long ago who owned a number of properties and you know, had significant net worth, and he just didn't have nearly enough auto coverage. And I think he had 100, and the 100 didn't come close to being enough in this case. And, you know, that's the kind of thing where we were able to work something out, but it cost him a lot more money than it would have cost to just have adequate insurance. And I think that's an important point too, Larry, that the difference between buying $25,050 and $100,300 is not that great. I mean, it's obviously more expensive, but the difference isn't as dramatic as you'd think, because of course the basic bet the company's making is you won't have an accident and you won't hurt anybody. And so that's the base cost of the insurance. And then obviously, you know, it's going to go up if you have higher limits, but it isn't proportional. And it's not nearly as much often as the cover if you're paying for coverage for comprehensive or collision, which is the coverage that protects your vehicle. So, you know, there are just things that there are all sorts of reasons why you need to look carefully at how much you have. And if it costs you a few dollars more to get the right kind of insurance, to get adequate insurance, that's really important.
You know, I've had the same agent, the same company for my entire career, you know, life. And I've had the same agent who just announced his retirement. And he's been very good. He's done a really good job for me over the years. But are there pros and cons of buying through an agent instead of a company?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the point you just made is really the critical point. If you have a good agent who's concerned about you and takes care of you, it's going to be a big help. I mean, he's not going to be able to increase the amount of your limits, of the limits you buy. But first of all, he's going to give you good advice on how much insurance you really need. And I know everybody says, well, of course, he wants me to buy more. You know, yes, they get paid on commission, but, you know, going up, you know, a few hundred dollars isn't going to make that much difference to him. But boy, having the right coverage makes a big difference to you. And good agents know that, and they're going to try to give you the best advice about what you really need. The other thing is, if you buy direct, and, you know, there's a lot of companies that are online now, or, you know, you can call them direct. And, you know, that's everybody pushes price. And of course, that's, you know, I love this. You'll save so many dollars. Well, people switch because they think they're going to save money, and maybe they are. And that's so when you switch companies, you almost always save money because that's why you're doing it to begin with. It's not that one company is necessarily always cheaper than another. You know, companies underwrite coverage based on a number of things, and they are different. I mean, companies have, you know, have different rates, and it's worth looking at a number of companies. An independent agent will do that. They represent, you know, more than one company. But that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with going to an agent that sells, you know, American Family or you know, State Farm or one of the other companies. There are, you know, good agents there. I think it's always good to shop around. And I haven't done as much of it probably as I should, Larry, as I'm giving everyone else advice. And, you know, it sounds like you haven't done a lot of it. But I think the relationship is important, very important. And having an agent you can trust to give you the best advice and get you the best coverage and the coverage you really need is very important. So, you know, I think that that's the thing to do. I think it is worth shopping around, but I think you need to make sure you've got somebody you can trust and that they're giving you the right advice about what you need.
Yeah, Tom Vetter has given me lots of good advice over the years. I'm happy to have had a relationship with him all these years. You know, there are advertisements from companies out there saying they'll buy life insurance from people. What should people consider before selling their life insurance?
Yeah, that kind of staggers me because, you know, there are obviously different kinds of life. And I mean, there's all sorts of different variations, but basically you've got whole life policies, which usually are policies that have cash value. You pay in over the years. Part of it is insurance. Part of it is investment. And that's the nature of whole life insurance. You can call it all sorts of different things, but that's kind of what it is. And the other stuff is term insurance. And term insurance generally means you're buying insurance for a fixed term. It usually doesn't have cash value. Obviously you pay less. And, you know, if all you're concerned about is protection, and a lot of people would argue that's really what you should be concerned about with life insurance, then, you know, term insurance is just fine. What I don't quite, I guess my concerns are these. First of all, if what you're buying is whole life insurance, then, you know, and that's what they're offering to buy from you, then first of all, you should go to your company and see if you want to sell, what would your company give you? because, you know, people who are in the business of buying things then are not doing it for altruistic reasons. You know, they're buying it because they expect to make a profit. So, I mean, if you're in effect letting them get the money you should have from your own insurance company, that doesn't make a lot of sense. So before I'd ever consider selling a policy, I'd go to my own company and say, you know, this company says they'll buy this. What, you know, if I give it back to you, sell it to you, whatever, surrender it is usually the way they term it, you know, what will I get? If it's term insurance, I guess I don't quite understand. Most states, and I think Wisconsin's one, have, you know, what they call an insurable interest law. So, you know, I can't go and take out insurance on a stranger and then, you know, effectively bet on him dying while the shit policy is enforced and collect the money. And I guess, you know, anybody who's listened to the old time radio mysteries or read any of the old mysteries knows that that's not a good idea because, of course, it incentivizes somebody doing away with someone. So I just think before anyone jumps into that kind of thing, just know that people, and I'm not saying they're archdemons or anything, but anybody who's in that business is in the business to make a profit. So the question is, what are you getting out of it? And wouldn't you be better off just to deal with it on your own? And I think before you ever consider selling the policy, that's certainly what you should do.
Let's take a call, Mike. Let's go to Tom in Madison. Tom, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, good morning, Mike and Larry. At the end of last July, I fell on my way into my workplace over a rolled up carpet that was not visible when you opened the door. I ruptured my quadriceps tendon in my right leg 85% and had to get corrective knee surgery. Actually see my surgeon next week, and I am continuing with both clinical and aquatic physical therapy, and I am gaining strength, but a lot of this therapy is covered by workers' compensation. I have not taken any paid time or anything from workers' comp, but my issue is there a period of time by which I must file a notice of injury and claim? I'm basically waiting for my doctors to say I've reached maximum medical improvement and then arguing, you know, is there a permanent partial disability or not? Would you have any advice for me on that front? I have not consulted an attorney yet.
Sure. And I think ultimately you may want to. And again, most attorneys who do that work, just like the kind of work I do, which is personal injury work, you know, a consult's free. Nobody's going to charge you for that. And it's always good to talk to somebody, you know, who does that work. And I have done comp, but it's been years. Generally speaking, the statute in comp is long. It's usually, I think, up to 12 years from the last payment. And they've been making payments at least on your medical bills. It sounds like you've continued working, so they haven't paid temporary total disability or temporary partial disability. Is that's right?
That is correct. I have an accommodation. I'm working from home, and I'm only using workers' comp for the continuing medical expenses, and I'm careful to, you know, segregate that from any other medical expense I might have.
Okay, that's great. What you want to do, first of all, so people understand, workers' comp covers injuries in the workplace, whether anyone's at fault or not. It sounds like someone was here because they left that rug where they shouldn't have. But the bottom line is whether anyone's at fault, the company's at fault, you're at fault, it doesn't matter. Workers' comp covers those injuries. They'll pay the medical bills. They'll also pay temporary total disability if you're unable to work. And then ultimately, they're going to pay permanent partial disability, which is really what you're asking about, Tom. And PPD it's not like a personal injury claim. In a personal injury claim, we have general damages, which really are pain, suffering, and the loss of enjoyment of life. In the comp system, what you get is the disability in terms of your ability to continue working in the future, and it's a percentage. So what they do, it's an interesting system. It always reminds me of those policies we used to get when we were school kids, that if you lost, you know, your right eye and your left arm, they gave you so much money. I don't mean to make light of this because this is a serious injury, but it is a percentage. So in this case, they'd probably do a percentage of disability compared to losing your leg at the hip. And that's all, then it's all percentages. And the percentages are fairly straightforward. And ultimately what's going to happen is, you know, your doctor is going to give an opinion and then they're going to come up with a percentage. I still think it's important to talk to a lawyer and just see if that percentage makes sense. And it may, you know, it may not be that you need somebody. It's a very different system than personal injury, where really, if you had an injury of this sort, you really should have a lawyer. With comp, it may not be necessary, but I still think it's important to consult a lawyer. I don't think you've got any time constraints to be concerned about. Certainly, there's nothing before your doctor says you've reached maximum medical improvement, which doesn't mean you're all better. It just means you're as good as you're going to get. And we see that in both the personal injury system and in the comp system. And then ultimately, the doctor's going to talk about what level of function you've lost, and that is what will determine the permanent partial disability number. If it were personal injury, just because people, this happens, the personal injury statute of limitations is 3 years, which means within 3 years of the time you're injured, you either have to settle a claim or bring a lawsuit. It's much more, these periods are much longer in workers' comp. So I don't think that's a concern. But again, I would reach out to a lawyer who does comp and just talk to them about that and see what they have to say.
Tom, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. Mike Riley, senior partner in the Axley Law Firm, our guest today. Clara Neipert, our producer, our on-air producers, Jill Nadeau, Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking with Mike Riley, senior partner in the Axley Law Firm of Madison, and taking a look at car insurance. We're talking about the bail system. Perhaps we'll get to that. And if you have some legal questions, I hope you'll join in. Questions about uninsured motorist coverage, maybe. Are you having problems with an insurance company because of an accident? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Let's take another call here. Tyrone in Milwaukee. Sorry, Tyrone. What's on your mind today?
Yes, good morning, Larry. Well, it almost tripped you up this morning, but that's okay. You got it right, Larry. Good morning, Larry. Good morning, Mike. Yeah, Tyrone.
Hi, Tyrone.
Yes, good morning. Northwest side of Milwaukee, Tyrone speaking. Good morning, Milwaukee and surrounding areas. Well, first of all, you know, I appreciate the fact that your honesty and all, you know, and, you know, yes, it is a business. They are in it to make the money. And the agents that are trying to really share and care for the individuals like Larry's agent and, you know, others there, that's wonderful. Yeah, I would have to say they're far and too few between. Quick illustration. My brother passed in 2013. The policy we had, we went through the ringer and all there. It turned out that after, you know, all these years of paying into it and all, It didn't even bother to be good toilet paper. I mean, we didn't hardly get anything. We got them cremated there, but it didn't do anything that it said that it was going to do for what we put into it. I'm pretty sure you've heard of the term pump and dump. So some companies may do that. You hear some people fire coverage, flood coverage, all that stuff there, you know, different things like that. What can we do as a country and as a people to see that our agents really do, like you say, care for us and want to see that we get the best out of, you know, there's the small print that really trips you up, you know, well, no, we don't cover that. And, you know, we can't do this. So you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I mean, Tyrone, you know, it's not unfamiliar, believe me. And I understand exactly what you're saying. Let me just make a couple points. First of all, and I'm not suggesting it will cure anything, but it's worth filing a complaint with the insurance commissioner's office. From my perspective, that office used to be really good. My more recent experience hasn't been as positive, I would say. I don't think they're as proactive, and they're all too... It's all too common for them to say, well, there's a dispute, so we can't really intervene. And I don't like that. I think that's exactly their job. But it is their job, and it's worth making a complaint if you have something like that. I think, you know, and it's easily, much easier said than done, Tyrone, but I think that's why you do shop around. You try to find an agent you trust. You try to find somebody who will do the right thing. I think it's also important. And look, I say that as a lawyer. Ask me if I've read every word of my policy, and the honest answer is no. I pretty much know, because I read those policies all the time, what they say, because they're pretty standard. But the bottom line is, it really is critical to read the fine print. I also think anytime you're buying a policy that's kind of a specialty policy, there's a lot of these, this hunter's insurance, and this sounds like maybe it was a burial plan. I don't know exactly what the policy was, but a lot of those policies, to me at least, there's a lot more problems with them than there are with a standard auto policy, a standard homeowner's policy, something like that. They often, there's nothing amusing about Tyrone's story, but I just heard one where the other day, and it's a good example of these specialty policies. Somebody was in a golf tournament, they had a hole in one thing. So they had, you're supposed to have four people because it was a scramble. They had three. So one guy hit twice on his second shot, he had a hole in one, and the company refused to pay because it was his second shot, even though that foursome was entitled to four shots. And I will say that I think you get more quibbling over those kinds of policies. You have more, as Tyrone said, more fine print. And I can tell you, as somebody who worked for insurance companies years ago, the profit margin on policies like that, the hunter's insurance and things of that sort, companies pay out very little money on that insurance, very little money. So they make a whole lot more proportionally than they do on auto insurance or, you know, health, well, certainly on health insurance, but almost anything else, those policies are. So if you're buying something like that, I mean, really think about, what's it costing you? Is it really worth it? Would it be better to put the money aside? And I know that's, again, easier said than done. But those policies, to me, are something you need to really look at carefully when you buy them. If they're making promises, get the promises in writing. If they're telling you, we'll do this and we'll do that, say, fine, you know, you give me a letter confirming that this is what you're going to do, and then I'll think about buying the policy.
Yeah. Tyrone, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Megan in La Crosse, we'll go to you next. Hi.
Hi, Larry.
Hi. What's on your mind?
So I have a question. We just moved into a new rental property about a week ago, and it's an old Victorian house, and the windows tend to not stay up on their own. So we had a window open, and our cat was laying underneath it, and the window fell down on her paw. So we made the landlord aware of what happened, and our cat ended up breaking her leg. So our landlord filed a claim with her property insurance, but we're just wondering, like, how likely is it that that will be covered under her insurance?
That's interesting. I actually had my oldest son was at one point going to go into the pet insurance business, and he didn't do it, but one of the guys he was going in with went in, became a vet, or maybe was a veterinary at that point, and opened several clinics, which he just sold for a whole lot of money. So I know vet bills are not cheap. You know, they are, emergency clinics, and those things are, it can get expensive real quickly. You know, your landlord would have liability insurance, and that's what would probably cover it. And the argument would be that the home wasn't properly maintained, and that's what caused the injury. And that's a legitimate basis for a claim. So, you know, I would think that there's a decent chance they would cover it. I'd also think that if they didn't, that the landlord would step up and take care of it, because clearly the windows were not properly maintained, or they wouldn't just fall down spontaneously. And, you know, I mean, I'm terribly sorry about your cat, but thank heavens it wasn't killed or that it wasn't a child.
Yeah.
And it's a dangerous situation. So that's, you know, I think there might well be liability coverage. And hopefully if there's not, the landlord would step up, as I think he should.
Megan, thank you so much for calling. Larry,
let me just make one. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. Mike.
Point. Because she raised the question, and I hadn't mentioned it in my materials I sent to you, renter's insurance is really important. If you're renting a property, please get renter's insurance. If something happens that's your fault or nobody's fault and, you know, your property's destroyed, boy, oh, boy, you know, that can be a huge loss. I mean, you're replacing furniture, clothing, and that, you can rack up thousands and thousands. And the other thing is, if, and I've seen several of these claims, if, for instance, you leave something on the stove, I've seen people, you know, bring packages in from FedEx and put them on an electric stovetop, not realizing it's on, and you end up with a fire. As the tenant, you're going to be responsible for the damages to the property. And if you don't have tenant's insurance, that can be a real problem. Even if the landlord has insurance, it may or may not cover that. But even if it does, his insurance company will likely come after you. And say, well, wait a minute, you caused this, you should pay. So it really, you know, people think, well, what do I need renter's insurance for? Well, that's a good reason. And, you know, we could talk about homeowners when we have a minute, but, you know, renter's insurance also has liability coverage, which would cover that situation. But also if somebody's, you know, somebody's at your home and, you know, they trip over a rolled up rug, as our prior caller did, or something, and injure themselves, you could be responsible for that legally. So it's a very good idea to look at renter's insurance. It's not very expensive, and it'll give you some peace of mind.
Yeah. Megan, again, thank you for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Lines open, we'll get you on pretty quickly. Steve in Boulder Junction wonders, why does it take so long for cases to go through the courts, even seemingly simple ones?
Great question. I can give you a few answers. And obviously, one is that it's gotten much worse with COVID. I mean, everything went on hold for a long time. And then a lot of things were being done by Zoom and still are. Trials just don't work by Zoom. Other things, you know, you can do a lot of the discovery, which is what lawyers call the process that where they're trying to figure out what happened and who's at fault. Those things Zoom works okay for. Trials, they don't. Now that we're back in, you know, with a lot of in-person stuff, although it's relatively recent, you've still got a backlog. And because criminal cases have speedy trial requirements, they get priority. So that really pushes, you know, the civil cases, which are what the injury cases are, but divorce and everything else gets pushed back. The other thing I think that's worth talking about is this, particularly in my part of the world where you've got, and I think it's true in other areas, including family law, we see more lawsuits in the personal injury area than we ever did. And there are a lot of reasons for that. As a plaintiff's lawyer, guy who represents people who are hurt, you know, I tend to think it's that the companies have become a bit stingier and it's not as easy to settle cases. And I think most lawyers, even defense lawyers, would say the same thing is true. It's just companies use computers more. There's less discretion for their people. I think it just makes it a little harder to get cases settled. So what's happened is a lot more cases go into suit. Fewer try, ironically. I mean, what's really is odd is that there are many fewer trials than there used to be 10 or 15 years ago. But it still takes time. Once you file a lawsuit, again, if we take a personal injury suit as an example, you know, then the lawyer, it goes to the lawyer, they get time to answer. Then once they answer, they send out a bunch of written interrogatories, which are questions about the person and the accident and how it affected their life. And, you know, we help the person answer those questions. Then at some point, we're going to schedule a deposition, and almost always the plaintiff, person who's injured, will be deposed. And then once that's done, the case goes to mediation. The vast majority of cases settle at mediation, which is a process where the lawyers agree to bring in a third lawyer who's now a lot of, there are many lawyers who specialize in doing mediation. And that person helps you try to reach an agreement. And 95% of the time you do reach an agreement. But by the time all that happens, you're at least 9 months out. If you need to go to trial, it's going to be over a year, almost certainly, from the time you file the lawsuit. So, you know, it's the nature of the beast. And honestly, short of getting the case settled before you file a lawsuit, it's going to take a while. And if you have a more serious injury, it's almost always going to take a year before your doctor's willing to say, yep, this is where you're going to be long term. And obviously, you can't really properly evaluate a claim until you know if someone has a permanent injury and how serious that injury is and how it's going to affect their life. So part of it's just built in to the system. If you have a minor injury that clears up in a few weeks or a month or something, those cases can usually get settled without taking that kind of time. But, you know, that's the reality.
Let's take another call. Spencer in Milwaukee, we go to you now. Hi, Spencer.
Hello. I just had a question about business insurance. I'm not sure what it's called, but two businesses. I was thinking about starting a walking tour business, and obviously people sign a waiver, but you need to insure in case somebody gets robbed or trips or falls or something like that.
Yeah, I think it'd be a good idea. For one thing, waivers are a good topic in themselves. They don't work. They almost never work. You know, I've litigated a lot of those. I actually litigated some of the first cases at the Supreme Court on those. And our court has set all sorts of limits on when a waiver will be effective. And somebody has to have, you know, you have to have consent. There has to be the ability to bargain the terms. And that's almost never the case. People have a standard form. They have to be fairly narrowly tailored. If they're overly broad, the court will throw them out. And the bottom line is, in Wisconsin at least, our courts have only enforced those generally in the area of motorsports, you know, or some other very high-risk sport where somebody knowingly is undertaking a significant risk. But in the, like a walking tour company, I don't think there's any way a company that, you know, the court, if you're taking them to climb Everest, maybe, but just on a walking tour, I don't think the court would enforce a waiver. You know, people in my office have clients ask about them, and I always tell them the same thing. If you think they're going to deter people from filing a claim, and they might, I guess they could be helpful, but in terms of actually protecting you from a claim, they're not going to do that. And it is important. I get the insurance again. One, it's important from a practical standpoint to have it, but it's also important just for your own peace of mind so you're not worried. You know, there are a lot of things that can happen that you're not going to be liable for. I mean, if somebody's walking down a trail and they trip and fall, you're not going to be responsible for that unless you took them down this incredibly rocky, unsafe trail that you knew about and they did. But generally, I mean, you mentioned somebody getting robbed. If that happened, God forbid, you wouldn't be liable for that, again, unless you decided to take them through an area where bandits were known to hang out. Not a lot of those in Wisconsin, as far as I know. It basically, people think their liability it's a much greater risk than it really is. I've seen that with all sorts of sporting events. People think that, you know, they want to put on a soccer tournament and they're worried about it. And, you know, I've so seldom seen any kind of claim in that environment. I mean, it's really, really rare. I've seen claims for rafting companies and things like that. But the bottom line is the insurance is probably not that expensive, and it's certainly worth having both for the peace of mind and to protect your assets.
Mm-hmm. Spencer, does that help?
Yeah, that's great. It's always debating because, you know, you don't have any profits to begin with. So do you want to pay for insurance that may never come up? I have a friend that has a pet sitting business, and I suggested she get that in case somebody accuses her of stealing or a cat dies or something. But she doesn't have it and doesn't. He's taking that risk. I felt like the insurance was necessary. So, yeah, that definitely helps.
All right.
Well, and you know, again, if your assets aside from the company are very limited, you know, that's something else. And I mean, you can incorporate, which may give you some level of protection. But again, if the corporation is simply you, then, you know, you need to talk to a corporate lawyer about how much protection you're actually going to get. But certainly incorporating is one thing you might want to think about as well.
Thank you, Spencer. Appreciate it. Mike in Winona, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi there, Larry. Yeah, I just got a storage unit, and I have a fair amount of valuable stuff that I'm putting in it. And I'm just curious, it's not in the best neighborhood. and if I should get insurance on that.
Yeah, I definitely would. I mean, first of all, I'd check with the person who owns the storage facility and see what kind of insurance they have and will it cover your goods or provide some coverage for your goods if something happens. But I'd also check to see what it would cost you to get the insurance. I'd check first if you have homeowners, check with your homeowner's carrier to see if they would cover that and whether, you know, maybe they would want an additional premium, but it probably would be better to do that than to go out and buy a separate policy. And you could check on both. But I think the homeowner's policy may cover it, but there are a lot of limitations. And sometimes they don't cover property that's, you know, away from the home. So particularly if it's a storage unit or something like that. So I would check with your agent first and find out about that. Maybe see if you need to buy additional insurance for that from them, and then check to see if somebody's willing to sell you a separate policy on that.
Yeah. Good luck, Mike. Thanks so much. I was thinking back to my time. I spent a year in Trinidad and Tobago, and as part of, I was renting a home down there, but still had my home back in Wisconsin, and there was somebody stole a bunch of my stereo and my TV and all that while I was away. And I thought, well, I'm just out of it. But somebody said, well, you better call your agent to see. And the agent said, oh, no, it's a homeowner's policy. You've got it. And even though you're not in your regular home, we cover, you know, you're now in another home. We're still going to cover it. So I had a very good outcome from that because I had the homeowners.
Yeah, and it's important to have the coverage. And as you said, it's important to have a good agent who will help take care of you. And, you know, look, let's face it. A lot of the stories we hear about insurance are horror stories. You know, they just are, you know, the Tyrone story. You know, you hear those things and they happen. I can, you know, tell you firsthand they happen because I see it. But, you know, the fact is there are a lot of good insurance companies out there. And frankly, I see a lot fewer problems with homeowners coverage and homeowners claims than I do with auto claims, with serious injury claims. Those are always going to be subject to much greater debate and, you know, are going to take much longer. But things like that are a great example of why you have homeowners insurance.
Yeah.
And renter's insurance as well, if you need it.
Mike Riley, our guest today, senior partner in the Axley Law Firm, as we talk about legal issues. You can join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at legal issues today with Mike Riley, senior partner in the Axley Law Firm of Madison. Great to have him with us. And certainly questions for him, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Mark in Middleton, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, I was in an accident here about a month ago, and I was at fault, failure to right away. In the accident report, I was not injured, and the crash report says possible injury. So I'm going to go to court and plead guilty, and I've got a fine to pay. I realize that. But beyond that, if I appear into the judge and we find that there was no serious injury, what would the possible penalties be? Do I lose my license for a period of time, or is that in the judgment of the judge after I explain the circumstances of the accident?
Okay, that's a great question. It brings up something we were going to talk about and hadn't quite gotten to. So first of all, Mark, I would not just plead guilty. You want to plead. If you're going to plead, you plead no contest because that doesn't admit guilt. Your insurance company will be happier with that. I know that, you know, you may not arguing about whether you were at fault, and it probably doesn't make much difference in this case, but that's a better way to go. The other thing is when you get a traffic ticket, you're going to get, you can simply appear by mail, plead not guilty, and they'll set it for a pretrial conference. And they may do that, just they may just send you something by mail, or you may have to appear and just talk to a DA or a district attorney, which would be a county charge, or a city attorney if it's a city charge, they'll almost always agree to reduce, use often the fine, often the points, but they usually will give you a deal that's better than what you get if you just plead guilty. So I think it's worth at least exploring that, first of all. Okay. Second, and if you have a question about that, you can follow up. Secondly, nobody's going to take away your license for a failure to yield. I mean, that's negligence. It's not gross negligence. If you're not driving while intoxicated, which are things that could take your license, you'll get some points. Wisconsin works on a point system, you know, and I think that's probably 3 points, whatever it is. You have to get 12 points in a year, or I think 18 in 2 years. The bottom line is that isn't going to take your license. It would, you know, barring a bunch of other tickets or several other tickets. So I don't think you need to be concerned about that. I'd make sure that even if it says possible injury, I'd report it to your insurance company to be sure that they have, you know, they know about it. I'm assuming you do have car insurance, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Report it to your agent or directly to your insurance company just so they know about it. I would say, I don't know that there's an injury, but it said possible, because I would say that the police tend to err on the side of underestimating injuries. I see things all the time where they say minor injury or no injury, where in fact there is an injury. That doesn't mean it's a terribly serious injury, but people at the scene of an accident often really don't know how, you know, how significantly injured they are. I mean, obviously they're not paralyzed, they're not dead. I mean, all that's wonderful, but you know, people get an adrenaline rush when you have an accident. Those who've been in one know what I'm talking about. And it's also just a shock. I mean, you didn't expect it to happen. Suddenly it does. And people often aren't really aware of what kind of injuries they have. It's often true, too, that injuries don't really surface. Most injuries are neck and back. I mean, that's the most common kind of injury. Those tend to be soft tissue. In other words, they're really muscles and ligaments. They're not bones. And so it usually often takes a couple, 3 days before things kind of stiffen up and you really feel the full effects of an accident. So, you know, from your standpoint, sitting where you are, the best thing to do is make sure you let your company know. They'll, you know, if they need to reach out, they will. Probably they'll wait to be contacted by the person who was injured or contacted by a lawyer. And then things will go from there. But you want to be sure you let your company know. That's the best thing to do. And you will not lose your license for this, period.
Now, if there is a lawsuit, not necessarily in Mark's case, but let's just say there's a lawsuit filed against you for an accident, what do insurance companies do then?
Well, that's a great question too, Larry. And I think the important thing to know is your insurance company has an obligation under the policy, not only to pay for the damages, but they also have an obligation to defend you against any lawsuit. And as we said earlier, there are exceptions to that. If it's a very serious injury or you have very low limits, they might decide to just pay the limits. But in most cases, first of all, before they do that, they're always going to try to negotiate a settlement. They're going to try to work out a settlement with the other person, whether he has a lawyer or not. And in a lot of cases will settle. Certainly most minor injuries will settle without a lawsuit. But, you know, if you get to a point where there is a lawsuit, first of all, if you're served with a lawsuit, it's very important to make sure your company gets that right away. You send it to your agent, send it to your company, and make sure they're aware of it. The company will then get in touch with you, and at some point they'll let you know they're going to assign a lawyer, and the lawyer will, sometimes it's an in-house lawyer. American Family has a lot of very capable in-house lawyers, and you know, they often defend the cases. Many companies use outside lawyers, you know, lawyers who don't work directly for the company. But in any case, often what happens is people will get a letter from the company that says, well, we don't know whether this claim may be worth more than your policy limits. And I get calls from clients who are panicked by that and say, oh my heavens, you know, the last client who called me has lots of coverage and the odds that there's going to be a problem are very small, but people are concerned about it. Usually when those letters are just things they send out on a standard basis when, you know, they don't settle a claim right away and there is a lawsuit. It's not something you should be alarmed about, but companies are not great about keeping you advised of what's going on. So I always tell people, if you want to know, follow up with the adjuster. They'll tell you who the adjuster is. Follow up. You say, where are we? What's going on? They don't do a real good job of following up with their insureds. They don't, you know, their commitment in terms of the company and the adjusters, their focus is getting the case settled. It's not really what you want. I had an uncle who's a defense lawyer, great guy, a very fine lawyer. And he once said, well, Mike, the customer doesn't want us to settle the claim. And I said, well, you don't pay any attention when they do. And he laughed and said, you're right, we'll settle. And that took care of that. But it just is true. They don't pay a great deal of attention to the insured. They do have an obligation of good faith to try to get the case settled within your policy limits. And if they're not getting it settled, you should point that out to them in a nice way that you're expecting them to do that. Once you get in a lawsuit, I talk to the lawyer. The lawyer who the company hires also has an obligation to you. In fact, his primary obligation is supposed to be to you ethically. The problem is he represents the company in an awful lot of cases. He represents you in one. And that's with no disrespect to defense lawyers, who are good people and capable people. You know, there's just an inherent conflict there. And if there's a serious claim where the lawyer's telling you it really could be, you know, there could be a concern about your limits, or they don't think it's worth that much and they want to go to trial, at that point, you ought to consider getting your own lawyer. I've represented a lot of people in that situation, and your own lawyer can often bring some pressure to bear on the company to get this thing done, because as an insured, your interest is almost never in having the case go to trial.
Mark, thanks again for calling. Frank in Brookfield, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Yes.
Hey, Frank.
Hi. I have a question about a collection that I have. I have a collection in my home of pocket knives that probably is worth about $10,000. And I don't know if that's covered by my homeowner's insurance or if I'm supposed to buy a special type of insurance to cover my collection in addition to that. And if I do, do I have to document my collection? And how do I do that? Or can I just buy like a set amount of insurance, like sometimes you can on an old antique car or something? You can just say, I want to buy $10,000 worth of insurance.
Yeah, that's interesting. First of all, in terms of documenting, and you've probably already done it, I'd get photos of all the knives. And if you've got papers that document, you know, how much they cost, might be a good idea to keep something fireproof or something off site so that, you know, you can document it. I would think that would come within your homeowner's care coverage. I mean, there are high value items like paintings and furs and jewelry. I mean, there are things where you may need to get special coverage, and you might be able to get that directly through your homeowner's carrier. I'd talk to your agent and find out if what he says about that. That to me is not such a high value. I mean, it's a lot of money. I'm not making light of it, but I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a $100,000 necklace or, you know, a painting that might be worth 50 grand or more than that. So my sense is that probably would be covered, but I definitely talk to your confirm. Again, maybe you just need to take out a rider that provides coverage for that shouldn't cost an awful lot of money.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. Frank, thank you so much. David emailed, he has an Airbnb rental, it's on a lakeshore, and he has a liability waiver written into his Airbnb rules, and wonders if this waiver holds him harmless if someone is injured or worse. Airbnb also has liability insurance through Lloyd's of London.
Yeah, I think the Airbnb insurance would be fine. And you know, I don't know if he has insurance. I assume he has insurance on the building, which also should include some liability insurance. But two things. First of all, the waivers probably won't work. The only exception is there is a broad exemption in Wisconsin for recreation. It's called recreational immunity. And so in terms of using the lake, and I don't know whether that would apply in that situation. It doesn't apply to your home. If you invite people over to your home to swim and something happens, you're probably not protected by recreational immunity. It does protect, you know, if you have a property and that you don't charge admission to, I mean, city parks are subject to recreational immunity. It's very broad. I mean, most public land is subject to recreational immunity, and a lot of private land is too if you don't charge admission to the property. So, you know, and I'm not quite sure how that would work there. I wouldn't rely on it, but it's, you know, something if you wanted to talk to a lawyer who, you know, about that directly, you might be worth doing that just to see if that would apply. But again, there's lots of other things could happen that, you know, somebody could have a fall that's based on something wrong. Just because somebody falls in your home, you're not responsible. I mean, there'd have to be something that you did that was unsafe. But, you know, if there's a runner loose on the stairs, you know, there are any number of things that could happen that could subject you to liability. It's highly unlikely the waiver will work. Again, sometimes people feel named, right? The name is helpful. Generally speaking, it just is not going to, it's not going to exempt you from liability under most circumstances.
Michael Riley, our guest today, senior partner in the Axley Law Firm of Madison. It's great to have Mike back with us today. And certainly you can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. We're going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Mike Riley. He'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at legal issues on the show today with Michael Riley. Mike's a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm in Madison. His practice focuses on getting fair compensation for people who suffer injuries due to others' negligence. He also represents clients in insurance coverage issues, mediation, and arbitration. So, do you have a legal question? You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, and we'll get you on pretty quickly. Kim emailed that 2 years ago, she was hired full-time at a distribution center. She developed what a doctor called basal joint arthritis, basically the cartilage in the base of her thumb was worn away, and now bone on bone. Long story short, she quit due to the hassles from human resources. She now has an undiagnosed disability due to depression and anxiety issues. She feels the company owes her, but doesn't know which direction to go.
I definitely get in touch with a workers' comp attorney. You might have an employment law claim too. That's something I'm not sure, you know, I have much less knowledge of, although it's certainly a possibility. But I'd talk to a workers' comp lawyer because that sounds like a repetitive use injury. Those are, you know, not unusual, and they should be covered under workers' comp, you know, if it stems directly from the job, which it certainly appears to. And, you know, I guess there'd be a question whether there'd be a claim also if the depression stems directly from the job. Again, not something I'm nearly as familiar with, Larry, but I think the answer is I'd certainly reach out to somebody who handles workers' compensation cases. You know, I'm sure you can go online and find that in Madison. There are a number of firms that do it. And, you know, talk to them and just see what they think. I would hope they could help with the thumb claim, and I think they could at least give her an answer on the other potential claim as well. And, you know, she could raise with them the question of whether, I mean, if, you know, if there was some kind of retaliatory firing because she was complaining about the injury, that might give you a basis for an employment claim. Wisconsin's an employment at will state, as most states are, which really means they get to fire you for most reasons. And in this case, she actually quit. So, you know, she probably doesn't have a claim since she decided to quit. If she could claim it, if there's a basis, she might be able to claim she was forced out in effect. But I think the thumb claim's valid, and there might be a workers' comp claim for the other problems as well. She should certainly pursue that. And depending on what, you know, how severe this is, she also should consider Social Security disability. It would be worth looking into that. There are firms in town that handle those claims as well. I know a lot of them suggest you make your claim yourself, and then if you get rejected, come to them. But I think those things are all worth looking into.
Let's go to Sullivan in Green Bay next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. So I am a former insurance agent, and I was just calling in regards to the guy who had the knife collection.
Yeah.
Specifically, I would suggest for him to go and contact his agent and get that collection put on a scheduled property, because since it is a specific collection, it probably wouldn't be covered under the general policy for, like, say, personal property. And even then, if there are knives that were purchased in a set, so, like, say, knives 1, 2, and 3 were purchased together, you need to have documentation saying, 1, those were purchased in a set, and 2, then those could be insured together as a set. But if the entire knife collection itself was not necessarily purchased as a set, like, say, if you have 10,000 knives, for example, if you did not purchase all 10,000 knives together, you could not insure those as one set of knives. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Yeah. No, I think that's great advice. Like you said, the biggest thing is talk to your agent and find out under your particular policy. And I'm sure as an agent, you know, you've got good insight into that. So thanks for the call.
Yeah, thank you very much, Sullivan.
Larry, can I just make a couple quick points on some other things before we get to the rest of the calls? They're just things that I think are important for people. First of all, you mentioned uninsured motorists. That's mandatory in Wisconsin, so that's on every policy. And that covers you. If somebody hits you and they don't have insurance, then your own uninsured motorist coverage effectively stands in the place of the liability coverage they should have. So it's subject to whatever the limits are. The uninsured motorist limits are almost always the same as your liability limits. The one that is a problem sometimes is underinsured, and people should have underinsured coverage, because what that does is that will cover you in the situation where somebody has the basic 2550 policy and you have an injury, or even 100, 300, and you have an injury that's worth a lot more than that. Then your underinsured motorist coverage would step in, but it only pays the difference between what the coverage they have and the value of your injury. So the company gets to subtract whatever the underlying liability limit is from what they pay. The bigger concern is there are some companies, not most, but some, who will write underinsured limits for less than your liability limits. You should never, ever have lower underinsured limits than you do liability limits. That's just a really bad idea. And also, people should, if you have significant assets, you should probably look at an umbrella policy. They're not very expensive. They provide coverage over and above the coverage for your underlying liability policy. Some of them will cover underinsured and uninsured. You should check to see if they're going to do that as well, because that's important. Finally, last thing. There are a lot of companies now, including some major in-state companies, that limit coverage for injuries caused by a dog under your homeowner's policy. Normally, that's what would cover those injuries. But if you have a dog who has attacked someone previously, even if they didn't cause a serious injury, your coverage, even though you might have 100, 300 or 250, 500 or whatever, that coverage may be limited to $25,000 if your dog has a prior history of attacking. And that's something you should be aware of. You should check with your agent again to see what your coverage is, and also what it is they define as a dangerous dog, because that's what they do. But the way they define it might be, you know, a lot broader than the way you or I would define a dangerous dog. And you don't want to be in a situation where your dog bites. Dog bites often involve children, because kids get their faces right down near the dog. And let's face it, a bite on the face is a lot more serious than a nip on the leg. And so those cases can end up with we settled one last year for $500,000. Those can be very serious cases, and you ought to make absolutely certain you have enough coverage and that it's not going to be limited by some special provision in your policy.
Yeah, very good advice. Gary in Green Bay will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Hey, I was wondering, so like you get hail damage on your house and siding and stuff like that, and the insurance company gives you like a check for, say, $20,000. But say you do some of the work yourself, and or the contractor actually comes in cheaper than what the insurance company gives you. What happens with the rest of the money? You get to keep it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if the company, what the company's paying you for is the value of that damage, and that's what you're entitled to recover under the policy. Now, a lot of policies require that the work actually be done before they'll pay you in full. But if the company says, okay, you know, here's the settlement, you know, you're accepting $20,000, we're paying you $20,000, that's that. I mean, that's your money. You're not, you don't, if you decide to do the work yourself, that's fine. You can do that. If you decide, you know, if the work comes in for cheaper than that, that shouldn't be a problem at all. I mean, you're not taking anything that you don't deserve. The company's made a judgment about the value of the claim. You're accepting that judgment. You've agreed upon it. And that really should be that.
Gary, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Alan in Janesville, thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. About 6 or 7 years ago, my mother passed away, and we hired a realtor to handle the lot plus the lot that the house was on. So anyway, the realtor sold the lot with a house on it and, you know, got the commission, but the lot next to the house didn't sell. And after about a year, we got kind of concerned about it, but we looked and they just quit advertising it. So I got another realtor from the same company, and I specifically asked her how much is the commission, and she said 7%. Well, we took a little bit less. About a few months later, the house or the lot sold that was next to the house. And when I went to the closing, it turned out that the commission was over 14%, and the realtor that didn't want to advertise it ended up buying it. And I thought it was kind of strange that the person that didn't want to advertise it ended up buying it. So he took a commission also, so it turned out being over 14%.
Yeah, I mean, that I find that really concerning. I mean, I talked to the, you know, a couple things. There's a real estate examining board. You might file a complaint with them. The first thing I'd always do is this guy the first person run the agency? Is there someone else who owns the realty company, or, you know, what's the situation there?
It's a pretty big company out of the region, and without giving the name,
okay. No, I definitely go over there. I mean, I'd go to somebody in the company and lodge a complaint and say, look, you know, we had listed with this guy. He didn't do anything. We then listed with another realtor within your company. There's no, in my mind, that's just fundamentally unfair for that company now to receive 14%, and probably for the first realtor to receive anything, honestly. But the bottom line is there's no way they should be charging you 14%. You know, we have situations in the law where people will hire a lawyer and then for whatever reason, you know, they don't get along and they decide to hire somebody else. I mean, we work that out between the lawyers. We don't, you know, double the percentage we're charging. You know, we say, okay, the fee will stay the same. We'll just figure out, you know, we'll work it out. You know, and that's to me the way that should happen. I mean, I don't know what the realtor's code of ethics says, but I think that's fundamentally unfair. And I think the best thing to do would be to go first through somebody higher up in the company, talk to them and see if they aren't willing to deal with it. And if they don't, then I'd think about filing a complaint with the real estate examining board. Now, you know, I don't know what they would do. I don't know if that's something that would violate their code of ethics, but it certainly violates, you know, just common sense about what's fair.
Good luck, Alan. Thank you so much for calling. Tom in Windsor, we'll go to you next. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. So a few years ago, I bought a pair of tickets for my wife and I to go see a concert overseas. And then COVID happened, and it got rescheduled, and then it got rescheduled. And I just said, you know what, I'm going to sell the tickets back, which was allowed. And I got an email, you know, saying, yes, we bought the tickets back. It's going to be a little while before you see the transfer money in the bank. And a few weeks later, I emailed them and said, hey. And they said, well, it takes some time. And a month or so later, I emailed them. They said, oh, it takes some time. Well, a few months later, I still haven't seen anything. Is there anything I can do with an overseas company, or am I just pretty much, well, suck it up and learn?
No, I'd give it a try. You know, one thing, and I don't know how much they can do either, but, you know, the local paper here, and I'm sure a lot of local papers have this thing where it's, I think it's called SOS in Madison, where they'll actually reach out to these companies. And sometimes, you know, that'll get things done. They seem to have a pretty good success rate. You're right. When you're dealing with somebody abroad, maybe, where are they? What country are they in?
England.
Yeah, okay, that's what I figured. You know, I'd reach out to them one more time and just say, look, the next step is, you know, they're doing business here. I mean, I'm assuming you're not the only one who bought tickets from them, which means theoretically, at least you could sue them here, and that judgment would be enforceable. Again, if they're crooks, will they care? Probably not. If they aren't crooks, you'd think that they would care. I'm trying to think if there's somebody else you could go to. I mean, I would...
Consumer protection might be.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. That's what I was struggling to recall, Larry, is who you call locally. But I think consumer protection is a great idea. You know, they're with the ag department still, right, Larry?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, I would reach out to them. Their state of Wisconsin consumer protection, because they might, you know, they might have a little more clout. And, you know, things like the Better Business Bureau, I don't know if it's going to matter to these people. But try consumer protection and see if that works.
And one other thing, if all else failed, I had somebody on a month ago or so talking about this, kind of same thing. And she, after many months, went to the company's Facebook page and posted a complaint on the Facebook page, and it got resolved in a week. They got them.
That's a great idea. Not being a Facebook guy, that didn't come to mind. My wife lives on Facebook. I so far have not gotten myself involved, but I think that's a great suggestion too. People don't like bad press, you know, and that's really bad press because everybody uses Facebook these days.
Tom, good luck. Thank you. Terry in Hammond, we'll go to you now. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I have a question if we have a leg to stand on. We hired a contractor about 3.5 years ago, and he started the job, and we're working on it. October will be 4 years, and he is still not done with that job.
Oh boy.
We had put an addition on.
Well, I don't think there's any question you have a leg to stand on. I mean, you could certainly bring a lawsuit against him, and I think he'd lose. I mean, that's nobody can claim that that's reasonable. I mean, even, you know, assuming with the disruptions from COVID and everything else. What's his excuse? He just probably took that much work and he doesn't want to bother finishing yours because he's got others that he can do. Has he already been paid?
Not the full amount. 2/3 of it he's been paid.
Well, I certainly wouldn't pay him anything else till it's done. How much of the work has he done?
He's probably got 2/3 of the job done. Probably 2/3 of the job done also. And there was no date on the contract that we signed. No ending date.
No, I understand. But I mean, there's always going to be an implied covenant of reasonableness. I mean, you can't take a job and say, yeah, I was going to finish it 10 years from now. I think you can go one of two ways. I mean, I think first I'd reach out to him and say, give him a date certain and say, either the work is done, you know, by whatever, 30 days from now, whatever's reasonable. And failing that, we're not paying any more money. We're done, you know. And then I know you have to get somebody else to do the work, and that's probably not high in your list of favorite things to do. But that's better than just letting it hang indefinitely. So that's what I'd give them, a time definite. And then, you know, again, you could do one of two things. You can say, or we're going to sue you. The problem is you're asking for specific performance, which means the court has to tell somebody you got to do this. They might, but, you know, all that's going to take enough time. So is it going to be worthwhile? Probably not. You know, if you can just if he's done 2/3 of the work and you paid 2/3 of the money, you know, I'd give him a time certain. If he doesn't do it, I'd just say we're keeping the rest of the money and we'll get somebody else to finish the work.
Well, there you go, Terry. Thank you. Maria in Kenosha, your turn. Hi, Maria.
Hi. I have a piece of land that my neighbors asked if they could garden, and I said yeah. If they, you know, they use like a rototiller and maybe a lawnmower. If they hurt themselves, am I liable?
No. Nope, absolutely not. No, the fact that they're on your land doesn't make you liable. In fact, that probably actually is a recreational immunity thing, where you recreational immunity would protect you anyway. But the bottom line is you haven't done anything. Again, there's a common perception if somebody gets hurt in your house, somebody gets hurt on your land, you're responsible. You're not. I mean, if somebody trips over something that's in plain sight, that's, you know, they trip coming up the stairs, not because there's anything wrong with the stairs, but because they trip, that doesn't make you legally responsible. And nothing they would do to themselves on the land, you know, that they do to themselves would make you legally responsible. And frankly, even if they injured someone else, I don't think that would make you legally responsible either, because I don't think that you responsibility legally depends on your being negligent, that you're not as careful as most people would be under those circumstances. That's really the test. And there's nothing that you've done that isn't careful. You've just been a generous, decent person and given them permission to do that. So, no, I don't think you have any legal exposure there.
Thank you, Maria. Appreciate it. Andy in Fort Atkinson. Hi.
Hi. We belong to a homeowners association. I'm on the board. And we have a piece of property that we basically just mow and keep the trees trimmed and stuff like that. Would we need to carry liability insurance on that?
Generally not. I mean, again, be generalized every conceivable situation. But again, if people are allowed to use, that's going to be a recreational use. Recreational immunity in this state is very broad. There's a case where somebody was walking home across a park and tripped and fell in a hole and brought a lawsuit. And the court said, nope, that's a recreational use, even though I think a lot of us don't think walking home from work is recreation. But generally speaking, recreational immunity is very broad. It applies whenever you allow people to use your land for recreational purposes, which is a little ironic because you think, well, if somebody's trespassing, you know, they might have less ability to use recreational immunity. But the bottom line is, I don't see. And again, if you haven't done anything wrong, you can't set traps, or dig huge holes in the middle of it that are unmarked and nobody would see and use it at night. But generally speaking, you just there's nothing there that would likely create any kind of liability for your association.
Well. Andy, thank you so much for calling. And Mike, I want to thank you so much. We never did get to everything. We were going to talk about identity theft and a couple of other things. So hopefully you'll come back with us again and we can pick up those topics and perhaps some others as well.
That'd be great, Larry. It's always a pleasure. And the questions are always so much fun. You have a great audience.
Thanks, Mike. Michael Riley, our guest, a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm in Madison. He does a great job, and it's always fun to have him with us on the show. Tomorrow at this time, we're going to new heights, so to speak. We'll talk with the veteran rock climbers about doing the sport in mountain-free Wisconsin, although there's some pretty steep places to climb. And then we're going to learn more about flying kites. Anybody ever tell you to go fly a kite? Well, there a lot of people have apparently done that, and there's some really cool stuff that I didn't know about, and I hope you'll enjoy learning all about it with me tomorrow. That's at 11 o'clock tomorrow on the Ideas Network, the Larry Mueller Show. Thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store. I'm Larry Mueller.